Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
There's been few other cases in history, you know, of civilized people where human suffering has been viewed with such peculiar indifference. And I'm struck by that. I really am. I think, you know, we have a lot of work to do. Activists, scholars, people who are just simply concerned with democracy, about educating the citizenry, and to continue to be involved.
On this week's show, we speak to Michael about his newest book, Where the Water Divides: Neoliberalism, White Privilege, and Environmental Racism in Canada. Stay tuned.
My next guest is someone who has inspired many people, particularly Indigenous communities, by his writing, by his teaching. Dr. Michael Mascarenhas is a professor in the Science and Technology Studies Department at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. He is also a sociologist, and he has authored a very exciting book called Where Water Divides. I'm very privileged to have him on our program. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, I'm here.
Wonderful. You know, your work, Where the Waters Divide, Neoliberalism, White Privilege, and Environmental Racism in Canada, is an insightful book and one that is most inspiring. I wonder if we can begin by talking a little bit about the way neoliberalism has become this almost dogmatic fundamentalism of economics, and the policies that it has imposed has had significant impact on our society. I wonder if you could begin talking about what this way of imagining the world has done in terms of eroding some of the gains that had been made through struggle, by worker struggle, by civil rights struggle in Canada.
That's a great question. To be quick, I think what gets lost really is the politics, you know, politics of governance, decisions and debates around environment or labor standards or equity and welfare, more generally democracy. That becomes lost. That gets taken out of government. You know, and the main role of government today is basically pro-business. And I'm struck by the recent omnibus bills, you know, C-38 and C-45. You know, here we have 70 federal acts. We have the removal of Navigable Water Protection Act that reduces the requirements, the legislation and environmental assessment requirements from 32,000 lakes to 97, and from 2.25 million rivers to 62. Without any parliamentary discussion. I mean, so you have this massive environmental overhaul, re-regulation of environmental laws in Canada, which I think also will have a disproportional impact on First Nations. And it's done through a budget bill. It's not even done through government, you know, what proper governments are supposed to do. You know, that is one of the key pieces that you know, so government becomes really a mechanism with which to allow for business to operate. And increasingly you see governments not only in Canada but globally auctioning off, you know, natural resources and resource-based industries to transnational corporations. You know, in doing so, they transform areas that were once community managed as uncapitalized lands or common lands. You know, they're transformed into regulated zones for commercial logging, pharmaceutical bio prospecting, commodity crops, damming, the production of oil or the movement of oil. You know, you get a real alienation by the electorate. And, you know, neoliberalism is different. It's difficult to quantify. It's difficult to understand. You know, it's an assemblage that takes different routes in different places and has, you know, you're not likely to see a sort of an easy political philosophy when you actually see the practices in place. And it has become difficult, and it's sort of elusive in order to actually identify its consequences for different people. You know, from my perspective, You know, water and water problems in Canada and elsewhere, I think, are overwhelmingly a crisis of socially and economically marginalized groups, particularly First Nations in Canada. And so what I try to do in the book is to talk about how neoliberalism is a racial formation, you know, and that's difficult also in Canada, because Canada tends to think of itself as a multicultural country, and that, you know, that Canadians don't feel themselves as having a racial formation as in, like, the United States with a history of slavery. And so that's, you know, the audience I'm trying to speak to in the book, and that's the kind of a scholarship I'm trying to do.
You know, I'm really happy that you make that connection in your book, because when I think about power, I often think about what is the purpose of power, and can power be other than how it is presented to us as the ability to control outcomes, to control others. And in the system of capitalism, and, you know, under neoliberalism, we see this power being almost perfected through the kind of bureaucratization that you're speaking of, where we, the ones impacted by those policies, become its most fierce defenders. You know, we're the ones who enable those very unjust laws like Bill C-45 and Bill C-38 to become, you know, enforced. So I really appreciate how you make this connection. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what was the catalyst, what inspired you to write the book, and, you know, to make these connections, which to me seems so obvious and evident, but they're silent.
Right. You know, for me, I think the entry point for this work was, well, I started my PhD in sociology at Michigan State in 1999, and I was already interested in sort of neoliberal governance at the time, but, you know, the summer of 2000, Walkerton happened. And then, you know, so here you have a small rural community in southern Ontario of 5,000, and 2,500 people get sick, and 7 people die. And from drinking public drinking water, from just drinking water, you know. And that really, I think, shook me, because in part, I grew up in southern Ontario in a small rural town, not too far from Walkerton. But it wasn't simply Walkerton. You know, there was North Battlefield. And then there was, much later, there was Kaseshawa. But it wasn't only going on in Canada, because, you know, there was food protest movements. La Via Campesina was protesting all over the world. And then, of course, there was water wars in South Africa and Bolivia. So people, you know, people who had been marginalized were starting to speak out, in part because they were being impacted by 30 or 40 years of this type of governance. And so I became particularly interested in First Nations in Ontario and how they were dealing with this. And, you know, it came to me as a surprise that, you know, there are about 95 boil water advisories in Canada in any given day, out of the 650 First Nations in Canada. So a large percentage of First Nations have abominable housing conditions, and, you know, they don't even have basic entitlements like clean water and sanitation. You know, people were writing about neoliberalism, were writing about privatization, commodification. I started to look at what was going on in Ontario in particular. So under Mike Harris's, you know, Common Sense Revolution, and he brought in a whole bunch of repeals, you know, to land use planning requirements, the nullification of municipal bylaws intended to regulate, you know, the environment and natural resources. You were able to approve waste disposal sites without any public hearing or input. It reduced the monitoring and reporting requirements of industry. There were major reductions in the budget. And, of course, this huge devolution of authority down to kind of local governments or to the private sector. In a sense, you know, he just simply privatized in a very short period of time many of the resource and environmental industries in Ontario. And that, for First Nations, really exacerbated, really intensified the environmental inequity. You know, so now you could sort of put a sewage treatment plant 2 or 3 kilometers from upstream of First Nations without having them participate in the process, without having to go through an environmental assessment. And, you know, there was a real lack of any discussion, not only about what was going on, but also about this what I call this sort of institutional form of racism, both in scholarship but also in the media and in the public debate. You know, the sort of dominant liberal institutions, if you will, you know, the media, the church, the university, the so-called left-wing parties, you know, the arts and the labor movements, over 20 or 30 years really have become an appendage to corporate power. You know, so there's no place to kind of get an alternative perspective other than the common sense discourse that is all pervasive. And I think to a certain extent, you know, there is a collective amnesia of Canada's racist past, you know, and present, that not only shapes to sort of establish the racial structure of today's society, but also legitimates it. Just give you a couple examples. I mean, I was really struck by the response of many kind of, you know, good Canadians in Caledonia, you know, in 2006, when there was a protest with the Six Nations because the subdivision was going into sacred and burial lands, and they put up blockades, and there were good white Canadians, you know, talking about Ku Klux Klan, talking about a final solution to the Indian problem. The mayor got up on the television, was saying, you know, these people need to understand, we need to go to work. I mean, really, you know, derogatory and racist, you know, just purely racist description of First Nations. And the same thing with the Idle No More movement. You know, I'm really struck at the response, again, by white Canadians, the racist response of white Canadians to this movement. I'm teaching an environmental justice course right now, and I'm having one of my students look at the posts that people have posted after Idle No More articles on the website, like the Globe and Mail and the National Post and such, in part because many of those posts had to be removed because they were seen as derogatory, they were seen as inappropriate, and so I'm trying to get a sense of, you know, what public opinion actually is of these types of movements. And so I think it's important to kind of, you know, to kind of connect this, that in fact, you know, it is silent, but it's a really important social question. And I think, you know, in many ways, it's difficult to, I think, understand and appreciate, I think, what white privilege is. You know, I think in part because we often think of racism as we often associate with hostile and intentional acts, which are very bad. But we often even associate institutional racism, like neoliberalism, with something that puts some people at a disadvantage. But what we don't do, and what we're not taught, is to see one of institutional racism's corollary aspects, and that's white privilege, right? That puts whites at an advantage. And the majority of white Canadians continue to associate racism with individual and malicious acts, and because they do that, you know, they can kind of exonerate themselves from the racial formation of the Canadian state. And so, and you know, it's not too difficult. I think it's important to recognize that whites in Canada have accrued unearned social, economic, environmental privileges at the expense of and of the health and welfare of First Nations. I mean, and that evidence is abounding. I mean, you know, they have privileged health, wealth, housing prices, educational attainment, drinking water, environmental equality. You know, just recently I was reading Niskatanga First Nations up in James Bay. They've had 7 deaths and 20 suicide attempts in this year alone. You know, Indigenous peoples in Canada have greater poverty levels than the rest of the population. The unemployment rate is widespread, exceeds 80% in some communities. Assistance payments from the government are insufficient to meet basic needs. An estimated 1 in 4 First Nations children live in poverty without enough nutrition. Cancer, arthritis, tuberculosis, heart disease, all of these kind of public health issues are all much greater in First Nations communities than other national norms. And of course, like I said, suicide rates are higher, and Aboriginals clearly make up the majority of incarcerated population in Canada. So there, you know, there is a lot of evidence to suggest that there is a privilege that goes along kind of racial lines in Canada, and I think we have to acknowledge that, and then, you know, be able to distinguish how neoliberalism is a particular racial formation, and how that actually works to disadvantage some groups of people and advantage others. And I think we need to be able to be clear on that if we're going to, you know, try to correct it at some level.
I'm so happy that you make those connections, because as you point out, these are often ignored. And when we talk about the economic collapse in Canada, we talk simply about the economical difficulties that the corporate sector or the well-to-do are experiencing. In many ways, for Latin Americans, for indigenous people throughout the world, the crisis began long ago. The crisis began with capitalism, with colonization. You know, so this idea that the crisis is temporary, that has only began in 2007, speaks to that kind of violence of blindness to what is evident to those who are affected. So can we talk a little bit about this hierarchies of violence then? Because it seems to me that the hierarchy of violence is always unarticulated, you know, it goes unspoken, right? Those with property have right to do violence to those whose land we want. You know, those with power, economic power, can declare that navigable rights, you know, of rivers can be simply dissolved, and, you know, profits and corporation who wants to export water. So central to this discourse on neoliberalism is this ethic of individualistic rights. Because we're not talking about communal rights, we're not talking about responsibilities, we're talking about the individual right of one to profit. Can you speak about this?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, you know, I think I write about it as the marketplace of neoliberal nature. You know, you just go and you purchase your right from whatever it is, whether it's healthcare or school or drinking water. And I think the problem with that logic, as pervasive as it is that markets are very good. I'm not anti-market. They're very good at and they can be efficient, but they're only good at providing consumers with goods and services. They're not good at providing citizens with entitlements and needs. And so this idea that the market is going to provide individuals with safe shelters and good water is you know, it's an ideology more than anything else. What ends up happening then is you start to think about democracy around types of populations, and you forget people who are citizens. That is a real sort of problem in terms of thinking about individual purchasing solutions. You know, the idea that we could kind of shop our way out of safety, at the same time as you have this massive disparity in wealth. So, you know, in the United States, I think it's 42 families own 62% of the nation's wealth. And increasingly, we're seeing through deregulation and other forms of regulation, increasing wealth disparities in Canada and globally. I mean, we're seeing, you know, at the same time as 70% of the Indian population lives on less than half a dollar a day, those sorts of inequalities are just not sustainable. And we have to sort of, I think, rethink this idea that, you know, that environmentalism or socialism has to be fundamentally at the level of individual action. I think that's important. I think people need to be aware, you know, need to be aware that there are greater risks in, say, food systems and water systems and commodities, in part because of the way things are produced these days, but also not only to simply buy local and you know, buy bottled water, but to actually look at, you know, what are the conditions that people are doing these things, and to kind of really, I think, speak truth to power in that sense and move away from, you know, only individual actions. I'm not saying that people shouldn't buy locally and buy organic foods, but that also is a form of privilege. You know, organic food's not available to everyone. It's not available to all areas. And so that in itself is a sort of a very kind of private of responding to the threats of neoliberals.
One of my friends said to me, you know, I Don't Know More is a wonderful expression of how we stop the capitalist system. And of course, my ears perk up. I'm like, yes, I'm listening. And he says, you know, don't you see, isn't it interesting how within a week they were able to get on national TV, CBC Radio is doing a cross-country checkup on I Don't Know More. And he says, and that's because the veins of capitalism were choked. They knew exactly where to apply pressure, and that pressure went directly to that, you know, the lines of consumption and production, right? So the rail lines were stopped. You know, and he says, you know, if we realize that we have this power to stop the system from doing harm to us and do something else, he says, we would, you know, we could do it and we can do it. I often ask people, you know, how do we turn back the clock on neoliberalism? How do we turn back the clock? And what alternatives could we put in place?
I think it's important to remember that the whole history of capitalism and most other social relations as well, societies, has been at some level one of struggle. I mean, everything that we sort of, you know, take for granted today. I mean, the fact that the women can vote, that the fact that indigenous people can vote, the fact that, you know, we have a minimum wage, as bad as it is, but we have health standards, we have environmental standards, we have, you know, children not working in factories, at least not in this country. You know, those things were fought for. Those things, capital never gave us any of those things. And so I think it's important that people need to remember that. And so people need to be involved. But as people were in the 60s and 70s, I think people really need to get involved. And to also think that, you know, racism is not something, nor is sexism, and other forms of discrimination is something of the past. You know, we didn't win, you know the environmental fight in the 60s. We didn't win, you know, the feminist fight in the 60s. That, and in fact, these things are still quite alive and kicking. Part, a very important feature of our stratified society. And so, to that extent, you know, that to look at racism as contemporary and actually something that is going to be part of future political economies. It's no longer okay to be silent. We've certainly got to speak out against hostile, intentional acts of racism wherever they occur, you know, in our libraries, in our shopping malls and theaters, but we've also got to fight institutional forms of racism and white privilege. And, you know, we can't rely on old racial stereotypes like people do to explain modern forms of racism. We've got to differentiate, I think. We've got to advocate for gender equity, racial equity, and other forms of inequity. I really do believe that, you know, the key to a healthy democracy is an educated citizenry, and that's part of the reasons I teach. And I think, you know, that we need to educate and re-educate kids and students and adults on forms of racism and sexism and other forms of stratification. I'm still struck, even after I've written that book and have had interviews and talked to other folks about, you know, really of the peculiar indifference, you know, still around the general public and government institutions, you know, with regards to environmental racism in Canada and the United States. You know, I'm still reminded of the words of, you know, W.E.B. Du Bois, who wrote in 1899 around, at that time, you know, the health of the Negro, he called it. And he said, you know, there's a peculiar attitude of the nation towards the well-being of this race. You know, he says, there's been few other cases in history, you know, of civilized people where human suffering has been viewed with such peculiar indifference. And I'm struck by that. I really am. I think, you know, we have a lot of work to do. Activists, scholars, people who are just simply concerned with democracy, about educating the citizenry, and to continue to be involved.
I'm very privileged to have been able to have the opportunity to speak with you, and I hope to do this again. I wanted to ask you, within the academy, as you point out, there's this willful indifference, and to me it doesn't seem surprising because no one gives up their privilege willingly. So unless we create a different way of engaging, where being competitive and deceitful doesn't profit you, you know, we won't be able to get out of that. We won't be able to create a society based on reciprocity and fairness. So what inspires you that we can do this, that we can not only bring down institutional racism within the academy, within the government, within the way we imagine the world, but that we can also learn and teach each other to live in ways that leads to coexistence?
What inspires me? I think it's, you know, I think it's important to educate people. I think that's what inspires me. I'm a minority, and I'm like many minorities in Canada. I've experienced racism all through my life. and in not only in Canada but in the United States as well. And you know, and you become aware of how that works. You become aware of how power works when you don't have it. And there's lots of folks who don't have it. I think what those folks lack, and I don't mean to be derogatory at all or condescending, but they lack the maybe the confidence, but also the networks, but also the vocabulary with which to speak about these issues to those people in power. And I think, you know, that's part of what we need to do in terms of people like us who can see this, is to educate people. And I think when people become aware of their privilege and the fact that it is uneven and it does have, you know, dire consequences for people, that people then will change. And they're always going to find people who probably won't, but that's not my general sense of what human nature is. And so that's what inspires me. I think, you know, teaching in particular and writing this and other books helps, but, you know, I see the change I have in my students who I would characterize as conservative, many of them, most of them, in fact, but just having them open their minds just a little, you know, to the potential that, hey, maybe I've got it a lot easier than others. If we can just get people to think for a while, I think to pause on the possibility that then change is possible. But it takes vigilance; it really does, and it's not fair because those who are marginalized are often left with responsibility. But it's worth it.
Thank you so much for being with us. Your book, Where the Water Divide, Neoliberalism, Why Privilege and Environmental Racism in Canada. How can people access your books?
It's sold by Lexington Books, and you can get it on the net.
Thank you again for being with us this morning.
Thank you so much.
We have come to the end of our program. Latin Waves is a weekly syndicated program available to campus and community radios. Please visit our website, www.latinwavesmedia.com, to hear previous shows, connect to our media projects, and access other resources, or to support our efforts by making a safe PayPal contribution. I am Sylvia Richardson. Thanks for listening.